I am René Arnoux, and you must to listen like me, F1 Weekly.
There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
You want to
keep up the good work, Stephen, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go with the qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Fall, my co-host. Nasser Hemi will be bringing us Motorsports Mondial in the second part of the program. This is podcast number 481, January 13th, 2011. Steven?
This F1 Weekly podcast is brought to you by the Google Ads. Click on them, you know you want to.
Thank you, Steven. On today's program, F1 going HD in 2011. Would it be stupid to go up against Fernando? And Derek Gardner, dead at 79. Of course, we have Motorsports Mondial with Nasser Hamid. And stay tuned for part two of the repeat interview with Nigel Mansell. Steve, welcome to the studio. How are you?
Wonderful, Mr. Rogers, and yourself?
Absolutely wonderful. We've straightened out a few things in the studio. Things are getting back on track.
We now have a no background noise podcast. Well, or at least no static.
Yes, we're working on everything. We're here to please the listener.
Yes. Period.
But anyway, great stuff. Of course, you know, it's still the off season, and a lot of talk about Vettel going to Ferrari. Ferrari talking about they need a perfect season. Of course, there's people saying that maybe Mercedes Grand Prix is looking for Vettel because they're the all-German
and they
squad.
Need a perfect season, and everybody needs a perfect season.
Come on. It's very interesting about Vettel going to Ferrari and teaming up against Fernando Alonso, and I'm really glad this has been ended by some interesting statements, and one of them was, Will Sebastian Vettel be lured to Ferrari in the next few years, insisting the world champion would be stupid to go up against Fernando Alonso? And of course, I still don't know if Sebastian Vettel has a manager or not, but any good management team would tell you, you don't want somebody like Fernando Alonso, who demands to be number one, to be your teammate. I think if he's going to go to Ferrari, he's young enough, he should be replacing Fernando Alonso.
Yeah, that's what I think I mentioned last week, is that, you know, I could see Vettel at Ferrari, but after Fernando moves on.
Exactly.
Not at the same time. It doesn't, and frankly, for a team, I don't think it really pays to have two drivers of that caliber, especially a team like Ferrari, racing against each other. You know, I can see McLaren getting away with it, maybe, but or, you know, some other teams. But Ferrari is too high profile for them to have a 1 and a 1A. The Italians would just, you know, tear each other apart.
I agree. And it's interesting. But we're going to hear a lot about this for the next few weeks and more about Vettel because he is the youngest world champion to date. And this is just the way it is.
You know, the way to stop this is for Red Bull to step up and give him a contract extension so we can't talk about it.
Yeah, but contracts are contracts. But Helmut Marko also said for Sebastian Vettel to leave just for the legend of Ferrari, that's not going to happen. And I sort of disagree with that. I think the legend of Ferrari is the allure.
Well, ultimately, it's like an extra $1 million kind of thing. To be able to say you raced for Ferrari, and if you can win the championship with Ferrari, you're enshrined in the halls at Maranello against, beside some of the most famous drivers that have ever raced in this sport.
That's very true. And I don't know why, but Helmut Marko seems to be, you know, stirring the pot on this, because he's also come out accusing Mercedes vice president of motorsports, Norbert Hogg, of going out after Sebastian Vettel. Which, I mean, it'd be stupid if he didn't.
Ultimately, yeah. Because what? He's got two more years on Schumacher's contract.
Yeah.
And I believe that Vettel's what is two more years at Red Bull. Why not lay the groundwork for possibly bringing Vettel over?
It makes perfect sense. Mercedes, Germania, you know, the whole kit and caboodle. But of course, Norbert Hogg went out and said, "We have not made Sebastian Vettel any kind of offers. We have exactly the drivers we want, Michael Schumacher and Nico Rosberg." Michael's still going with his comeback and hopes to get the results he wants. The Italian, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, it's interesting that the problem is the press is sort of bored right now. And
they'll listen to anybody.
They're digging up as much crap as they possibly can.
Just to try to get...
to get readership.
People to look at the web pages.
Exactly. So, you know, I think that's all fine and dandy. Anyway, speaking of the Italians, Stefano De Monicali came out and said that their goals for 2011 is to win both titles, of course, and they want a perfect season. Now, they got the driver.
What constitutes a perfect season? Were they going to win all the races? Yeah. Because that would be the perfect season, would be to win every race.
Pretty much.
And I do not believe that has ever occurred in Formula One.
It's gotten close. I think the Miami Dolphins did it one year. but no, it was McLaren, and it was 15 out of 16, I believe. But very interesting stuff. Still, we'll see what happens. I just can't wait for February. The cars are going to be starting to pop up at the end of January. We got testing in February.
We should see the Renault livery a little bit in another day or two.
Well, we know what it's going to look like. But still, I'm looking forward to see what the cars look like, not just the liveries. You know, because I want to see that adjustable wing.
See what the shapes are now?
We got KERS and a full tank of fuel.
How piggy these
cars.
That's
a lot of weight.
Well, I want to see how wide these buggers are now that they've got to get the fuel tanks and KERS in there.
It's going to be great. I can't wait for it. But anyway, the exciting news, of course, is HD is coming to Formula One this season.
Yeah, and what took Bernie so long?
Well, it's not Bernie. You know, the television stations have to jump on board. Bernie is an old man.
What's this matter? Would you know? Just broadcast it in HD where it can be broadcast in HD and, you know, standard def everywhere else.
Well, the Germans announced that they would do it first. And, of course, the BBC announced rapidly that they would be commencing HD as well. Along with many, many HD viewers, I'm delighted that we'll have a chance next season to see Formula One in all its glory on television, said Danielle Nagler, head of BBC HD and 3D.
Now you're talking. I want to see Formula One in 3D. Yeah. That'd be cool.
So we could all go into convulsions.
It'd be fun to get that camera on a corner. You know, have that car come right into your living room.
It's fantastic news that FOM has decided to give the green light for HD broadcast, and we're looking forward to sharing with the fans all the races and all their detail on BBC One HD. And BBC HD. The BBC also confirmed that former team boss Eddie Jordan will continue to be part of its commentary team, of course.
Brundle and Coulthard were already named this week.
They will be in the commentary box with Brundle taking the head spot over Ledgerd. Ledgerd saying, he tweeted that he knew he was out. He has been let go. And, some people liked him, and some people hated him.
Which typically goes with most commentators on some level. Most people, you either love them or hate them, or you're indifferent. But you usually end up with a number of people who don't like a given commentator.
Yes.
You get a bunch of people who love them.
It does happen. So there you have it. I'm pretty pumped up. And speaking of television and coverage. ESPN has signed a deal to cover the World Rally Championship.
No way.
I swear to everyone that, yes, ESPN channel will screen 30-minute nightly bulletins at the end of every WRC day with on-event coverage bookended by an hour-long preview and review show. Between events, ESPN is committing 30-hour-long shows with archive material from the sport, as well as two new documentary programs. So ESPN,
of which one will be Sebastian Loeb, the man who dominates this sport?
Well, there could be a lot of other things happening, including, you know, with Block being in there. And we have Mini Cooper coming in.
It does help that you're going to have three cars, and the fact that we're going to have the Americans going full time.
Yes. So it's going to be fun, and I'm really glad to hear about that.
Yeah, it's good to see them, you know, and to me it's like, okay, where were you, Speed TV?
Speed TV just couldn't afford to do WRC and Formula One.
But they were buying the WRC coverage that they had previously, they were buying from somebody else anyway.
I know. And but still.
It's okay. ESPN 14 covers the WRC.
Yeah, ESPN, I mean, Speed TV is not really interested in showing international motorsports. It's just not their viewership. It's either NASCAR, trucks, you know, dune buggies going through mud.
Or semi-car-related reality.
Pink slips.
Reality-based television.
Yes, it's not a motorsports channel anymore.
No.
We
should change their name.
Of course, big news, Derek Gardner passing away at 79. Of course, he helped win the title-winning Tyrrells in the 70s and created the team's famous six-wheeler. Gardner moved into Formula One when he worked with Ferguson to help develop four-wheel drive system for the Matra in 1969 before joining Tyrrell's team the following year. He helped design the first Tyrrell 001, which was built in his garage and put on pole position at its first race in Canada by Jackie Stewart. The Tyrrell 003 was taken to the world title by Jackie Stewart. 006 helped the Scottish driver to his third crown in 73, and although the end of that campaign was marred by the death of François Sévère at Watkins Glen, as well as his title-winning success, Gardner was also widely known as the brainchild behind the unique six-wheeler Tyrrell P34 that raced in 1976 and helped Jody Scheckter to victory in that year's Swedish Grand Prix, which I believe was held at Dijon Prenois. Although he had created another race winner, Gardner became disillusioned with F1, and he left the sport at the end of that year to work for the Borg Warner Company. So there you have it. Derek Gardner has left us. And of course, what a legacy that was. And that's one of my favorite Formula One cars, the Tyrrell six wheeler. Absolutely outstanding. And of course, I'm sure Nasser Hamid will have some historical commentary to post during the Motorsports Mondial. Now, of course, we got some email this week because me and Steve went on ranting about four cylinders, blah, 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 blah. So, Steve, why don't you read our email?
This one's from David, and David's down under in Sydney, Australia. He writes, "Hey, guys, just been listening to Podcast 480 and listening to you guys complain about the four-cylinder engines. Have you forgotten about the BMW turbo four-cylinder putting out over 1,000 horsepower back in the 80s? Those things were absolute monsters. I don't understand how you could find that dull. Anyway, keep up the good work, David."
It's not dull, David, and I appreciate the email because I knew it was coming. We did get out of control with the four-cylinder issue. And my thing is because, well, first of all, we are Americans and we like big. Everything's got to be big.
We want big motors. You know, we would like to see Formula One cars with bigger motors than NASCAR.
That would be
good. Or at least more powerful.
Yes, but anyway, no, the BMW 1.5-liter four-cylinder turbocharged Formula One motor was exciting, but that would be the exception, to be honest with you, because I don't think we're going to see anything like that in Formula One in 2013. And I hope we don't, because this motor was old. By 1980s, this motor was already a dinosaur. And I'm going to, you know, maybe refresh everybody's memories on the BMW.
In the memory.
Also known as the M10, M12, M13 motor. And this motor, when it was called the M10, was introduced in 1961.
Wow.
That...
And, talk about some longevity.
Yeah. Well, which is good. A great design should last for a long time, which is fine. I agree with that kind of engineering. Of course, famous for powering the F1 cars of Brabham, Arrows, and Benetton, and of course won the world championship in 1983. As BMW M12, the engine design since the 1960s became one of the most successful engines in racing. Starting with the European Touring Car Championship, it was also used in Formula 2. Expanded to 2 liters and fitted with a four-valve head, producing over 300 horsepower in the Deutsche Rennsport Meisterschaft. A 1400cc variant was turbocharged by Paul Roche, according to FIA Group 5 rules. As well as over 350 horsepower, from the beginning it rendered the normally aspirated engines in the 2-liter category useless. After some development, power, drivability, and reliability improved, especially in the IMSA car, and BMW began to think about entering Formula One, where a handicap factor of 2.0 required 1,500cc engines. Now, this was a great motor, and when they designed it so they could increase the cubic centimeters, depending
volume
on their applications.
The brilliant design from the way it's reading that they paid, whoever put it together did a really good job.
It was a great motor, especially once it became turbocharged. It was a monster. It was an old design, but it was so durable that they stuck with it. In 1986 and 87, the version M12 and 13 was tilted sideways by 72 degrees for use in the extremely low, of course, I'm talking about the famous Brabham BT55. The design was not successful, probably because of severe cooling issues. The 86 engine was said to produce about 1,300 horsepower.
Out of a four? Wow.
Yes.
And only 1,500 cc's?
Yep. Crap. It's pretty impressive stuff. BMW announced pulling out officially at the end of 1986. The Arrows team brokered a deal with support from its primary sponsor, which is USFNG, to continue the use of the upright BMW engines under the name of its subsidiary, Megatron. Founded by longtime F1 aficionado John J. Schmidt, who coined the phrase, horse racing may have been the sport of kings, but auto racing is the sport of corporations.
Little did he know that he really nailed it.
Very, very interesting stuff. And of course, Megatron continued to race these BMW engines for Arrows 87 and 88, as well as Ligier, who raced them in 87 only. The Megatron program ended as a result of a change of Formula One engine rules, which banned turbocharged motors at the end of 1988. And of course, Arrows, when that ban came in, reverted to the use of the 3.5-liter Ford Cosworth V8. Normally
aspirated.
Yeah. So anyway, that was an old power plant, and we saw it peak in the mid-80s, and that was the end of it. But still, we're never going to see something like that again. The four cylinders we're talking about today are going to be completely different, maxing maybe at 12,000 RPM. And it's going to be definitely a different kind of beast. But what's great about these BMW engines, they're out there at historical races. You could see the BT55, the Brabham, which was a great car, designed by Gordon Murray and David North. for the Brabham team owned by your very good friend, Bernie Eccleston.
Yes.
And of course, used the BMW four-cylinder turbocharged engines tilted over on its side to allow clear supply of air on the rear wing. Great stuff. And yeah, if you go to a historical race, check out the Brabham. They're out there racing, I'm positive. And these BMW engines are fairly rugged. And that's why you see a lot of them at some of these historical races. Yes. And we see them here at Laguna Seca and our favorite Cedars Point.
It was originally
Point.
Designed in 61. I can just imagine what that would be like in the 80s with the better metallurgy. The thing would be just...
No, yeah, as time goes on, you
bulletproof.
Get not only better metallurgy, but you improve things. And of course, you have improved tolerances. The biggest change in Formula One motors and engineering came when the metal springs could not keep up with the high RPMs. And that's why these kinds of motors really were obsolete. Metal springs couldn't keep up with the high RPMs. That's why when Renault developed the pneumatic valve system, that changed everything, and that's certainly not going to go away.
Yeah.
So there's my story, and I'm sticking with it, Stephen.
Sticking to it, man.
Exactly. So yes, we have some great cars coming up at the end of the month. We've got testing coming up soon. Of course, stay tuned for the second part of the Nigel Mansell interview with Nasser Hamid, and of course, Motorsports Mondial. So we'll be back after this brief message.
Hi, I'm Clark Rogers, host of F1Weekly.com's podcast. Please visit our website, F1Weekly.com, your fresh new destination for all your Formula One needs. F1Weekly.com brings you a weekly podcast that covers the latest news, rumors, and insightful commentary related to the pinnacle of modern motorsports, Formula One. You can find us on iTunes and other popular podcast locations. F1Weekly.com. Thank you.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the king of Karachi himself, Nasser Hamid.
Greetings and 2011 racing regards. Happy New Year to all the F1 Weekly familia. Mr. Rogers, you had a good New Year's Day, and Mr. Fab, you too?
Me also.
All is good.
All is good? Shall we proceed?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Big question is, what will the new season bring? Will we see a repeat champion, which has been a tradition last so many years, or will there be a second coming for one of the McLaren Brit boys, which has also been a tradition? You know, Nando went two in a row, Schumacher, many in a row, Hakkinen. So we'll see. Or will Nando bring home a third title on a prancing horse? He needs to know in the desert Petrov can't remember his name and Hamilton will give no love. So the work is cut out for all of them. Preseason testing is starting soon and that will hopefully give us an idea who is where. Red Bull may still have the edge, but McLaren and Ferrari may be closer than they appear in Red Bull rearview mirror, especially of Sebastian Vettel. Lotus Renault, or whatever they are called by the time the season starts, should be in the mix, should be able to mix it up, as they have one of the best drivers in the lineup. Of course, I'm talking about Robert Kubica, who has been told, thou shall not drive in Monte Carlo.
He wanted to drive a competitor's car, not the Renault that was provided to him. And there are contractual problems there.
Yes.
You know, you can't be seen in a Citroën when you're driving for Renault. Yeah. There are rules to play by.
Exactly. Ross Brawn and...
slapped a Lotus on the side of it and let him go.
Open mind.
Yeah, as always. Ross Brawn and company should be able to fix the broken aero for the 2011 season. Time will tell if Nico has been an underrated driver or time has really come for Der Kommissar from Kirpin to call it quits. What do you think will happen this year?
I think Schumacher will perform. Nico will be with him, and they will be a happy German team.
Now I'm hearing some reports from Ross Brawn that Pirelli's might not suit Michael Schumacher. I've never heard of such a thing. Something will not suit, and this guy was running away with everything in his prime days, and now he's struggling to meet.
Well, let's not forget, it took a little while when Schumacher went to Ferrari. They built the car around Michael Schumacher, and Bridgestone was pro-Ferrari. Everybody got the leftovers.
Well, the car he walked into at Ferrari was a dog, so nobody was going to...
Yeah, so it's going to take a little time.
That's right.
I think that, don't worry, the problem is Pirelli is an Italiano company.
They're going to be pro-Ferrari. Oh, conspiracy has already started.
Nando.
Oh, boy.
The new Pirellis will say on the side, Nando.
Yeah, and I won't be surprised.
I won't be surprised.
But,
either.
You know, I mean, really, you have to have the package. But going back to the Michael Schumacher situation, you know, I was very confident before the season started last year that
were.
He will overpower Nico. But after seeing this all season long, I think Father Time has caught up to him.
Well, let's not forget that we are all vulnerable. And so is Michael Schumacher. The problem is, you know, he had built up such an empire that we thought that he was like a rock.
Yeah. And then the car he came back to was so completely different.
Yeah. That's the biggest problem. And it turned out that he's just like everybody else. A regular guy.
When he's been away from the sport for 2 years.
Yeah. So,
His age, I thought he performed quite well.
No, for his age and coming back, and of course, very good. No question about that. Okay, moving on, shall we?
Please.
Okay. Over at Team Willy, Adam Parr is busy telling anyone who will listen that Pastor Maldonado was not signed for sponsorship only. They must like his good looks, you know. They can turn him into a Grand Prix winner. While Pastor is no Nakajima of Venezuela, taking 4 years to win GP2 and then replacing a kid who won the same championship not only in his rookie year but as teammate of Maldonado, I think Adam is not being frank nor using his head. What say you, Mr. Rogers?
Oh, head Frank. Boy, is that another America song?
It is. See? Thank you very much. Okay, this was really a pleasant surprise. First F1 surprise of the season had a spicy flavor when it was announced that HRT has signed Naren Karthikeyan. He is the first driver to, and this is even more impressive, he's the first driver to graduate back to Formula One after a season in NASCAR Camping World Truck Series on Goodyear tires with Sunoco oil. And I think it may have a few more lines there. But we have some rules here, too. After all those high-speed turns at Talladega and Darlington, Eau Rouge at Spa will now feel like a Brussels sprout to him. What say you, Mr. Rogers?
This whole thing is unbelievable. They drop Bruno Senna. You know, and he wasn't terrific, but he was driving a pig. They bring in Naren Karthikeyan. Obviously, there's some kind of sponsorship money coming up. We've got the Indian Grand Prix coming up. Something is afoot.
Yes, and it's not the big foot.
No, it's not.
It's the big wallet.
And then, of course, they walk away from photo.
Yeah, I mean, that's what happens if you don't pay your dues.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Many are wondering why Naren is not at Force India. Looks like there is some bad masala between him and Malia. Naren raced at Jordan in 2005. His day of days was at Indy, where he was fourth behind teammate Thiago Montero. And I believe you were at that historic race.
One of my favorite races.
Yeah, mine too. Karthikeyan then had a huge crash in the Chinese Grand Prix. That was a massive, massive accident. You know, now that he's back in Formula One, we did an interview with him last year, so maybe we should replay that.
That's a good idea, Nas. Yeah. Talk to the people in the archives.
Yeah, and he was driving for Chowski's, Le Mans team.
One of our favorites.
Yes, sir. Naren was very thankful to Tata Group while tweeting his return to Formula One. Tata Group is like the GE of India. They also own Jaguar and provide consulting services to Ferrari and much, much more. And if I'm not mistaken, the big, huge Indian state-owned airline Air India, in days gone by, when it was established 80 years ago, if I remember correctly, this was also started by Tata people. Okay. Force India may sign... This can happen any day now. Force India may sign Paul Di Resta and buy out the contract off with Antonio Liuzzi. So he's getting the shaft again, if it happens. the Italian should come here and race in Indy cars with his Toro Rosso buddy Scott Speed. Misery loves company and lots of money. Apparently, he has a very solid contract. You know, they have this contract recognition board in Geneva, so he probably will have to be paid by Dr. Malia, unless Dr. Malia wants to get sued again, which is, they have become the most sued team now, which is pretty sad for a guy who has a multi-million-dollar Empress of India yacht and is a multi-billionaire. But that's the way.
We all have our hobbies.
That's the way the samosa crumbles sometimes. HBO had Red Shoe Diaries. We have Ron Dennis Diary. Men who worked on cars driven by Jack Brabham and Jochen Rindt and then led McLaren to championship glory with Lauda, Prost, Senna, and others has named Mika Hakkinen's near-fatal crash in 1995 as the worst memory in his long McLaren career. Hakkinen crashed in the streets of Adelaide and was very lucky to survive that accident. I'm sure you remember that.
Yeah, it's brutal.
Yeah. The finest moment for Dennis was Lauda winning, giving his team their first World Drivers' Championship in 1994. Oh, excuse me, 1984. That's a typo. We need a new secretary, Mr. Rogers. We need a new secretary.
Hakkinen was there in 94.
Yeah, it's 1984. And it was a very interesting situation that year. This was in the final race at Portugal, where his teammate Alain Prost finished ahead of Lotto to win the race, and Senna was third in his Tolman.
Tolman?
Yeah.
Benetton?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Which became Benetton. Then it was Ziegfried Tolman. That was a beautiful paint scheme. I like that. Hakkinen for his honesty, Lewis for his uncompromising attitude, and Senna because of his passion were named by Ron as McLaren's best drivers.
No Nando?
You know, he said, you know, I don't recall he drove for me. Ron became Ronnie.
Well, no, that he only drove for him for a year.
And what about Prost? What's going on here?
Well, so many great drivers drove for him, he had to take some names. But my favorite Ron Dennis Niki Lauda story is when he was at McLaren, him being approached by Renault, and they arranged like a private meeting in Paris, and he flies his own private plane from Ibiza, Spain, in the morning, comes back home in the afternoon, and there's a message from Ron Dennis on his answering machine. So how was the meeting with Renault? Very, very impressive. Okay. Moving on, in the Jacoby and Myers moment, the case of Chavsky versus Chutney is brought before the court. Dr. Colin Collis taking legal action against Karun Chandok and asking, where have all the rupees gone? Where do you think they've gone?
You know, all I know is Karun Chandok really is not getting a fair shake here.
Yeah. Apparently, the promised sponsorship did not come through, which was pretty obvious when he was replaced at HRT without any food poisoning.
Absolutely. It was ridiculous. And we all knew what was going on. But it's a sad state of, but this is Formula One today. You pay, you drive.
Yeah, people are saying it has become like, it was always like this. It was just not a big sport, so we hear it more now.
Absolutely.
Especially from podcasters, podunk podcasters. Okay, Dakar is in Senegal, but the rally now takes place in South America. And you know, this African continent, you know, they really screwed themselves. You know, they used to make a lot of money and a lot of good things were done for the poor local people by the event organizers.
Absolutely.
Amaury organization,
great,
I believe.
Great for the economy.
Great for the economy. And they did a lot of, built a lot of schools and put a lot of water pipes and stuff like that. And it's very sad. But South America is great for the event. V-Dub looking good for two in a row. My very long-distance cousin, Nasser Al-Athiyah from Qatar, or Qatar as the natives would say, and last year's winner Carlos Sainz of Viva España are the two top combatants in Volkswagen Touareg. And if you are wondering what Touareg is, apart from a V-Dub SUV, it is a North African nomadic tribe. Are you watching any of this on television?
Yes.
Enjoying it?
A little bit. I'm going online and watching some of it too.
Really? How about you, Mr. Fab?
Yeah, I've watched a couple of stages.
Okay, cool. What you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, bad boys. What
you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you?
What you gonna do when Polizei comes looking for $50 million? I'm sure you've read about this.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah, Gerhard Grabowski, who worked for the German bank Bayern Landesbank, has been taken into custody on charges of corruption, tax fraud, and breach of trust with his former employers. Sounds like a senator. One of the allegations labeled against him is that he led Bayern LB to sell its stake in F1 to CVC without a proper evaluation of its full value, and in doing so on a consultancy contract for himself worth $50 million. Apparently some investigative journalist was looking into this guy. He had set up some sort of a charitable trust thing, and then they saw $50 million coming in from Bahamas or Barbados. And they say, you know, was ist los, junge man? So they're going after him now. Let's see what happens. Bernie has dodged anything and everything so far, but someday the past caught up to Max and caught up to Flavio. Let's see what happens here. Not saying the big man is, the biggie is guilty, but let's see what happens. Somebody's going down. And it's, as Mr. Al Davis would say, going down very hard. Because that's a lot of money. And if you steal, because what happened, this gentleman was also involved in doing due diligence for this bank, and they bought a bank in Austria, paid millions and millions of dollars, turned out to be a financial disaster, and they had to sell it for €1. So he won't be getting a Christmas card from the board of directors of Bayern LB. Okay, at the time of the deal, which is the when Slack Holdings, because Bayern LB owned a 48% stake in Slack Holdings. This was the company that had the commercial rights to Formula One. And of course, everything was done by borrowing lots of money. When they sold to CVC for an undisclosed amount, nobody knows what that amount was and what the structure was of the deal. I don't even think to this day anybody knows that. But we shall see and keep our interest going in this case and update our listeners as more news comes out. Is this of any interest to you?
Absolutely. It's very exciting and intriguing.
Oh, absolutely. I'm curious how he got this money. I would like to find out, because they have these, you know, Atlas, Topco, all these companies that, you know, it's a maze. And most of these are set up offshore funds to avoid taxation. Oh, we have more banking news. This time in NASCAR land.
Exciting.
Oh, yeah. Wells Fargo coming through. Wells Fargo has stopped foreclosing on the NASCAR Plaza office tower in uptown Charlotte, North Carolina. The San Francisco-based company started foreclosure proceedings in November after being sued by its co-lender, Regions Bank. That is so beautiful. Regions and Wells Fargo each put up half of the loan, but Wells is charged with administering it. And the Regions is also alleging that at one time, Wells had the audacity to offer them 42 cents on the dollar for their stake. So, a lot of angry cheaters on this one. The lenders faced a $30 to $40 million loss on the loan because of rising vacancy rates in Uptown's office market. You know, our man Jackson, maybe we can have him do a sort of a appraisal on the property and see how many rooms are. Maybe we can move there for $1
a month.
Yeah. Do the podcast from there.
Mm-hmm. Move our palatial offices?
Yeah, high-rise, you know, North Carolina.
Whew, that would be exciting, wouldn't
Might
it?
Might still be able to get some office equipment from USF1.
There you go. They're just down the road. And NASCAR, not surprisingly, is the largest tenant with 118,000 square feet, followed by Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which has taken about 16,000 square feet. And talking, this might be of interest to you, sir, and some of our listeners. Talking of Wells Fargo, the two youths who founded the bank were also behind another famous financial concern, American Express. Ain't that beautiful?
Don't leave home without it.
Absolutely. And it's just like, you know, people who, at least one of them who founded Denny's were also behind, if I remember correctly, Winchell Donuts. So these money people are minting money everywhere, whether it's a Grand Slam or a glazed donut. Okay, now to your favorite driver of days gone by, Kimi Raikkonen. He will be back in WRC this season in a Citroen with his own team, Ice One. Wow. First we had Malaysia One, now we have Ice One. pretty soon. By the time he's, sooner or later, he's going to lose interest in rallying also to come to, like, maybe, you know, Mickey Thompson off-road thingy. Then his team will be known as Melt One. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I could see him doing the car at some point down the road.
His best finish, and I'm sure you know, mentioned that his dad passed away recently.
Well, that was a few months ago.
Yeah, a few months.
Oh, it was in December.
Just before. That was very sad, and it was very young, too. Kimi's best finish last year was fifth in Turkey. Let's hope he is a leg up this year and wins a WRC event. If he wins a WRC event, that'll be a huge, huge deal.
It's not going to happen.
It could be a freak. I mean, he has the pace to be competitive and a couple of guys.
If he wins one event, that would be exciting. But as long as Sebastian Loeb is there, it's going to be pretty tough.
Yeah.
Win the championship, really.
Yeah. Okay, now we move to IndyCar news. Edmonton race is back on the Schedule A, which is very good. It was a very popular event, but I understand it won't be at the airport that was holding the event. So let's see what happens. James Rossiter, you remember him, James Rossiter?
Back in the day.
Yeah. Ex-F1 tester may race in Indy cars with the support of Lotus, the Denny Bahar-flavored Lotus. Sayonara, possible Sayonara from Firestone. They did not renew their contract with IndyCar Series last year and may follow parent company Bridgestone in bailing out of a premier motor racing series, which will be very sad. But looks like if they did not renew, they probably will bail out. But, you know, there's always Goodyear, Avon, Cooper, McCrary.
Hankook.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, like, Hankook would be smart for them to move into the Indy Series since they want to get into the States.
Yeah, cool. Now your homeboy, Alexander Prémont, as Francais as you can get. I met him at Laguna Seca. It was very nice to me, and so was Nicolas Lapierre at the famous A1GP race. Boy, you cannot get more French than Alexander Prémont. Let me tell you, when you talk to him, and you will know what I'm talking about. Anyway, he is trying to get a drive with BMW and DTM. Last year, he was released from his Audi contract. His single-seater career was doing good. But then, so sad, he came down with Fernando fever. And Mr. Rogers, this is no Peggy Lee fever. Fever in the daytime, fever all through the race. You give me fever. And that's what I'm talking about. His 2006 GP2 teammate was LH. What more can I say? You know, what really...
How about bad luck?
Yeah. Well, so what happened with him is, you know, the inaugural A1GP season... Him and Lapierre were with the French team. They did. He won a lot of races. And next year in A1GP shows up Nico Hülkenberg. And, you know, he was on fire. And then when Prémont went to GP2 with Lewis Hamilton, it was le total disaster. But what do you expect, you know? I've heard him and Kovalainen tweet quite a bit.
Yeah.
So how was it? Oh, man. That's all this. Anyway, some sad news you mentioned about Derek Gardner, the man behind the six-wheel Tyrrell, passed away on January 10th at the age of 79. He also designed Uncle Ken's first F1 car in his garage. And I was reading a book or an article from Jackie Stewart lately that Jackie Stewart, for his seat fitting, went to his garage and sat in the tub there. How things have changed. And this car, Jackie Stewart put on pole in its maiden Grand Prix in Canada in 1971. And Gardner used to work before getting into Formula One and after his days were over in Formula One for Bob Warner. And you know who they are, right?
I would hope so.
Yeah, the Bob Warner Trophy at Indy, you know.
And they make good transmissions.
Exactamundo. Okay, now we come to famous last words. Robin Miller has a Miller's Mailbag on Speed TV. Do you ever go to Speed TV?
Speed TV, yeah, but there's nothing about motorsports anymore.
Yeah. Well, there's IndyCar and NASCAR, lots of NASCAR. But anyway, Robin...
Like I said.
Okay, Mr. Sophistication.
You stupid!
Yes. In Miller's Mailbag on SpeedTV.com, this is a comment from one of the...
One of your favorites, then.
Not one of the listeners or one of the people who are following motor racing. This is what the gentleman writes. Michael, and I did not know this, Michael Waltrip doing drinking and driving public service announcements is a little like Jeffrey Dahmer giving table etiquette advice.
That's just wrong.
Well, that's what the man... Have you seen any of these commercials?
No, I have not.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to stay away from
that. They're probably not played in California.
Okay. Possible. Or the East Coast. Anyway, with that, I am out of here. Mr. Rogers, have a pleasant evening and enjoy your dinner.
Thanks, Nasser, for another outstanding Motorsports Mondial. And now stay tuned for part two of our interview with Nigel Mansell.
1989 Rio, first race with Ferrari. You went first time out and you are then Il Leone with the Tifosis. What was the atmosphere working in an Italian team compared to an English team?
Magical. The Italian and Ferrari were just starting to climb up the ladder again, and it was wonderful to be part of their organization, and to win three races for them with the time I had with them there was fantastic. I enjoyed every minute. It was a great challenge. It was very a political team when I was there, and then shortly after I left and Prost left, you know, the complete rejuvenation of Ferrari came with Michael Schumacher and certain personnel. And I think it's wonderful the success Ferrari have had, and so richly and well deserved. And for me, I still think, you know, Williams, Ferrari, you know, Ferrari for me has still got the edge to be the best team.
Now, I read somewhere that you were the last driver personally selected by Enzo Ferrari. Sure. Did you meet him? Did you get to know him?
I had dinners with him and was signed by him. I was the last driver to be signed. And again, I felt very privileged because, you know, meeting the great man and seeing how he operates, and it was the respect that he had for everybody, but more so everybody had for him. You know, if he just started to move, everyone would be quiet instantly in case he wanted to say something. And it was a magical time at Ferrari.
Now, let me tell you, I've been following motor racing since 1973. The greatest motor racing pass, strictly in my opinion, that I would love to watch on YouTube, 1990 Mexico. Tell me about that, please.
Yeah, with Gerhard Berger. It was one of those maneuvers. A number of laps before, Gerhard locked up coming in down the straight and almost punted me off. I had to go left. The corner went right, so he didn't hit me. And he overtook me, what I feel, in a bad way, not in a good way. So I thought, well, I'm not going to let you get away with that. And, of course, I sort of picked the car up and drove it harder and harder. And I thought, well, going into the Peralta, I'm just not going to lift. I'm going to overtake you on the outside. And I overtook him on the outside, and it was literally one of those maneuvers which is very dangerous. It's a shit or bust maneuver, because if it comes off, you're a hero, and if it doesn't, you could kill yourself. And I've done a couple of those over the years, and it was a magical maneuver, and I know it impressed a number of people, because although I came second in the race, I was clapped by the whole teams in the pit lane when I came in, because they really thought it was the most amazing maneuver. So it was neat.
Did Berger have to say? I'll tell you, I was watching it with a friend of mine, and they're on TV live. It was showing Gerhard Berger in-car camera, and he's approaching. You come on the outside, and you're gone. And we just looked at each other, speechless.
He couldn't believe it either. He was in shock that someone could be that stupid to try and do that.
How does that stack up for you against passing Senna and Hungaroring?
Yeah, they're both very technical, very ballsy moves. The Hungarian, I boxed Ayrton in Hungary, and that was a great positioning. It was like a chess game, and that was with Ayrton to outfox him, and to win that race was very special.
1992, your championship year, and again a tremendous battle between you and Senna in the streets of Monte Carlo. Do you think there was a way to pass him if there was another lap or two left?
Probably, if I'd have lost my front nose cone, and you know, we could have had an accident. I mean, we were fighting tooth and nail, and Ayrton was like a bus in front. He was moving left, he was moving right, moving left again. Under the new rules now, he would have been black flagged. So you know, technically, I can look back and say, I should have been given that race. but it led for a lot of excitement. It was very dangerous. It was very frustrating because I had to concentrate on not having an accident at every corner because it was blocking all the time. But it was great motorsport. It was great motor racing. It was very exciting, and but also just a little bit disappointing because I'd like to have won Monaco.
Question: Canada, when you were waving to the people on the last lap, and you know, cars stop. What really happened there? I've heard that system shut it down, or you killed the switch. What's the truth?
The actual truth is that the old semi-automatic gearbox failed and put the car into neutral, and I just couldn't get a gear, and it was a great disappointment and great shame, and you know, what can you say? And then you have certain minorities of the press make up these stories that, you know, you knock the ignition switch off, and really it's so pathetic, it's unbelievable, other than the fact some people actually believe it. So it was devastating because it was the most perfect race. We had a huge lead, and I was actually taking it easy on the slowdown lap, and then you know, fate strikes, just like the tire exploding, which was a great visible thing in 86, which people will see, God, the tire exploded. With an electrical failure, you can't see anything. The engine just stops. So that's what happened.
Okay. Now, when you won the championship, you came to the U.S. Was money the only main reason that you left Williams and Formula One to come here?
No, I mean, the thing is when you win the world championship, you really expect to be given the opportunity to defend it in the manner that you won it. And, you know, there's no secret that Prost wanted me out of the team. And, you know, they offered me half the salary to stay there for the following year. And so that's as good as saying, well, you know, we don't want you there. When you're world champion, you've got to make the opportunities. I was offered a good deal to come to America, a new adventure, a new beginning. We lived in America at the time as well. And so, you know, destiny would have it that when one door closed, another one opened, and then it was like a fairy tale. Oh, yeah. We won the championship back to back. I'm the only person in the history of auto racing that held two championships simultaneously across the Atlantic. Only four people have achieved it, which is in no particular order, Emerson Fittipaldi, Mario Andretti, myself, and Jacques Villeneuve. So, you know, it's a special bit of history.
Talking of Alain Prost, I was reading an interview in Motorsports with Damon Hill, and he said that he did not learn a thing from Alain Prost, but he learned from Senna, with whom he only had three races. How was your experience with Prost as a teammate at Ferrari?
Alain is a very clever man, is very political. He works very much with the sponsors and the officials, and whatever he can do to get the advantage out of the car, he's very good at that. He's a very good driver, but he's a driver, he's not a racer. And so he used every means he can, and obviously, you know, I was privileged or lucky or unlucky to drive with three world champions, with Keke Rosberg, Alain Prost, and obviously Nelson Piquet. For me, the best world champion I drove from was Keke Rosberg. I learned more from Keke Rosberg because he was a complete racer, Keke, and he was a thoroughbred man. He was a great human being. He drove the car 10 tenths, and he was, for me, a real honest race car driver.
You won your first ever IndyCar race, and was that a surprise to you, and how did you find the competition, depth of competition in IndyCar racing in 1993 as opposed to Formula One?
In some ways, it was a lot harder in IndyCar because at that time there was always 6 to 8 drivers that could win the races. There was a lot more level of playing field. The tracks were tougher. It was a challenge learning the new ways. It was a challenge with driving for 30 odd years clockwise circuits to then come over and drive anti-clockwise circuits. The ovals were an enormous challenge, and obviously I found out at my first attempt how dangerous they were. 148 stitches in my back with a crash at Phoenix. But I enjoyed it, and you know, it's something to look back and reflect on, and feel very proud that I conquered America at the first attempt. And I still believe to qualify in pole position and win the first race has never been done since.
What is the key to going fast on an oval compared to road courses?
Close your eyes and hope. You need a very good team to set the car up. You need a good team to set the car up to put you in the window that you're in the ballpark, and then you need to be very patient in what I call perfecting the car, tickling the car, tweaking the car, and getting the balance as close as you possibly can to neutral to understeer. Any oversteer on an oval, it can bite you really hard. And you have to be patient, you have to get the staggers in the tires right, you have to get the cross weight right. There are so many things that you have to do. And you really need a fantastic team that understands oval racing to help you do that.
Mario Andretti was your teammate at Newman Haas, and he was recently quoted as saying that if Ronnie Peterson was his best teammate, he would put you on the other end of the scale. How would you respond to that?
Everyone has their opinion. I think my response to that is Mario, I think, is a very good person. He's a great world champion. He's done fantastic things for motorsport. I'm a father. I have two sons. I think the timing of me coming to Newman Haas was the timing when Michael went to McLaren in Formula One. And as we all know, Michael had a terrible time and experience in Formula One. Mario, obviously, is his father. I was having a great time in IndyCar, and I know it didn't go down well with Mario. I came over and won races, won the championship, and I know it was a tough time for him, but I think it's a shame that he took it out on me rather than actually understanding why he wasn't very happy with things.
Looking back at your career, your most memorable race moments, what do you really cherish from your racing career, not just Grand Prix?
I think the biggest thing I cherish is the fact that I came from nothing and I made a young boy's dream come true, which was mine, to stand momentarily on the top of the world on both sides of the Atlantic, win a lot of races, and still be here to talk to you today. Because in the 70s and 80s, a lot of our drivers were being killed all the time. Formula One in the late 70s, mid 70s, and obviously early 80s, a lot of people died. And I remember in 1980, 81, and 82 was horrendous years. And so to be here today, I look back with great thanks that we achieved some special things and some special memories. And as Gerhard Berger says, at the end of the day, when we're all gone, it's only the history books that's going to tell the story. And perhaps I've written a little bit of history where perhaps we'll be remembered.
You know, you made a comment, came from nothing. Where did you get so much determination that you had? I mean, I cannot even think of a guy succeeding in anything with all the obstacles you had to face. And I'm not saying this just because I'm sitting here. I must say this to all my friends.
I couldn't afford to fail, and I am stubborn, but I had this inner self-belief that all I wanted was equal equipment. If I was given equal equipment and I couldn't win, then I'd walk away tomorrow. I knew if I was given equal equipment, I could win. Being teammates with three different world champions and, three and four world championships, three times Nelson, four times Alain, and obviously Keke. I knew what you needed to actually achieve to win. And you have to be incredibly selfish. You have to have the team working for you, because in the 70s and 80s, the reliability of a Formula One car was not there. If you were outright number one driver, you probably, stats-wise, would finish 30% more races. If you finish 30% more races, you got a chance of winning the World Championship. If you're a number two driver, before you start the season, you might be able to win a race, but you're never going to win a world championship. And so, I learned an awful lot, and that's why I retired in 1990, because I was not being afforded the opportunity to go for world titles.
Your thoughts on what happened at McLaren between Alonso and Hamilton? And talking of Hamilton, do you think he's a real deal?
We'll see this year. I think it's too early to tell. I mean, you have to be in Formula One a number of years before you see what kind of situation you have I think Kovalainen will keep Lewis very honest this year. Kovalainen's a very quick driver. I predict there's going to be problems with McLaren again this year. I think it's going to be very interesting. And my my favourites is, I still think Ferrari are going to be good. I think Williams are coming on strong. I think Nico Rosberg's doing a fabulous job. It's good to see Red Bull. It's great to see BMW doing better. And I just hope there's a lot of cars within a second or so this year, so the competition is closer.
You know, when the first hint of trouble came between the two drivers, Alonso and Hamilton, and he was accusing of favoritism because Hamilton is British and so is the team, if you were Alonso's manager, what would you guide or advise him at that stage?
You sometimes just have to keep your head down and do the job, but you know, Alonso is a great world champion. Is a very quick, very talented driver, and you know, only he knows what contract he had with McLaren. But you know, I honestly feel that the whole situation was handled badly, and I think if McLaren look back at, you know, last year, they'll probably behind closed doors, that is, admit that they did a whole number of things wrong, and I think the whole PR exercise between their two drivers at times was pretty appalling.
What about the $100 million fine? You think that's excessive?
I think they're very lucky to still be racing. You know, no one gets fined like that if there isn't absolute proof. And I think if it wasn't for Bernie Ecclestone, they were going to be banned for this year as well. I mean, you know, to get caught with so many documents from, you know, Ferrari, I mean, what can you say?
No, you know, but Bernie Ecclestone, the Formula One has really become so big as it is right now. How do you look at circuits moving away from Europe, going to places like India soon, South Korea, Bahrain, places where they do not have a rich heritage of motor racing?
I don't think that matters as long as you still have a good balance of heritage of races. To take the Formula One on a world basis is just fantastic, and everybody in Formula One, and especially Mr. Ecclestone, should be, you know, complimented, because he's made Formula One what it is today, and is truly a global, incredible machine.
You've lived here and raced in the United States with a lot of success. What will it take for Formula One to have a real strong foothold in the U.S.?
I think Formula One needs to get a little bit leveler playing field, and they need to repair some of the bridges they've burnt, and obviously the terrible race they had here a number of years ago. I think in another couple of years, if they come over here and put on some sensational races and look after the sporting fans, the fans here in America will embrace it like all the other fans worldwide.
Your favorite track on Grand Prix circuit?
I mean, I have several. All the ones I win at are my favorite. But, I mean, obviously, my home track, the British Grand Prix. Winning three on a row in 85, 86, 87, doing the triple was very special. Two at Brands Hatch and then the one at Silverstone. But the most special circuit in the world for me was the old Oesterreich Ring. When we used to climb up, it was over 4 miles long, and the Bosch curve, and some unbelievable corners which were very ballsy.
What about everybody's favourite, Spa-Francorchamps?
Well, Spa is probably very close, yeah, absolutely, to the old Oesterreich Ring. But for me, the Oesterreich Ring just had it, but Spa's very close second, yeah.
How soon or how long before we see the Mansell name back in Formula One or Indy cars?
No idea. We're on this journey, as Paul Newman said to me years ago, come and have an adventure. Well, in 2008, we're having an adventure with the Walker Racing team, and we'll see where it takes us.
Okay, finally, how about a message for our listeners? And we have quite a few listeners in the UK, so if you have any message for countrymen.
Yeah, I mean, please come and say hello and support us. We're here at Laguna Seca in May. We're looking forward to having a fun, challenging time, and I'd just like to congratulate all the racing fans for all the support they give the racing in America, because I think motor racing fans are very knowledgeable, and they know how to behave, and it's just a joy to come and race in America.
Thank you very much.
Nigel Mansell, thanks again for joining F1Weekly.com, and now let's just go right to the wrap-up. Of course, we have no forum updates because everybody is on holiday. So I'm just going to wrap it up, Stephen. I'm going to mention the
calendar.
I'm going to mention the calendar again. We've got some left. People, please.
Google Ads. Help us out a little bit.
Click on the Google Ads. So far, 2011 is not working out for us.
Financially, monetarily.
Yeah, it's been rough out there. I don't know what we're going to do. So if you can buy some calendars, and you know, maybe we could talk to Nasser and get these calendars discounted.
Yeah, these last half dozen or two dozen that he's got left.
Yes, exactly. So we'll see what happens. Cameron Carding is proud to organize and support the 2010. You know, it says 2011 on my sheet, and I say 2010.
You're just still stuck in the past,
right? Well, I like being in the past.
We were financially better off last year, too.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to stick to it. Cameron Carding is proud to organize and support the 2011 Redline Oil Karting Championship. Cameron Carding offers CRG carts, engines, and parts for all carts, engine service, driver coaching, and trackside support to Northern California carters. For more information, just go to CameronCarding.com, and they've got a whole new program for 2011. It's very, very interesting. Of course, it's going to be at Infineon Raceway, regarded as the marquee karting track on the West Coast. And the series promoter, Steve Cameron, is committed to providing a safe, exciting, and professional racing venue for all racers in Northern California. And they're doing an outstanding job. They've got some added classes, junior categories. So this is a great thing to go check out. If you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, make sure you go to Infineon Raceway and mention F1Weekly.com. I want to mention our Facebook and Twitter sites, of course. Just do a search for F1 Weekly and add us as a friend. If you'd like to advertise or cross-promote with our website or podcast, email me, info@F1Weekly.com. We're talking rock-bottom prices here.
Good exposure inside the Formula One market.
That's right. Thousands of people listen to us. And if you just throw your product
all
in there,
all over the world,
you just become cool.
At the very least.
Exactly.
And you help out your favorite podcast.
Thank you very much. Thanks for listening and good night.
Good night.
This is Desiree for F1Weekly.com, thanking you, the subscribers and members of our listening audience, for listening to our podcast, reporting and commenting on Formula One, the highest echelon of motorsport. A blend of technology, tradition, glamour, and guts, all wrapped up in a high-speed package. That's F1Weekly.com for all your Formula One needs.